We have a pretty good idea when the humans will go extinct, Washington Post says. Well, that caught my eye. So the article goes on to say this: the probability of global catastrophe is very high. Bulletin of Atomic Scientists warned in the setting of the doomsday clock 2.5 minutes before midnight earlier this year on nuclear weapons and climate change, humanity's most pressing existential threats. The bulletin scientists found that inaction and brinksmanship, which means a cavalier attitude towards rule, have continued, endangering every person everywhere on Earth. Every day, it seems, brings with it fresh new horrors. Mass murders, catastrophic climate change. Now, that's the big one, of course. Nuclear annihilation. It's all enough to make a reasonable person ask, how much longer can things go on this way? Have you heard that question asked before? Even as believers, we ask that question. Well, we're going to get the answer here. According to the Princeton University astrophysicist, his name is Gott, we have between 5,100 years and 7.8 million years. And I wanted to just croak. I said, wow, that really helps. Well, one thing you don't have to worry about, it's going to be soon. 5,000, that's a long time, you know. So pessimistic prognosticators say that since we have scaled back funds for space exploration, that's a bad thing, they say, and because of all the bad things happening, we are all done in 100 years on the route we're on. But the more utopian-minded who see with outer space colonization that time could be stretched to billions of years, and I say, whew, wow, close call. Now, my words. In the article, no one warned of the coming doom. No one offered the best piece of advice. Amos 4:12 said, prepare to meet your God. Well, it was not offered because we know what's best for us. That meeting God assumes that God knows us, that we indeed are special, and more importantly, that we have something to do with him, assumes all that. All of this is denied under the cloud of false humility. And part of the article is that, you know, we used to think that the world was the center of the universe and everything spun around the world, you know, the sun spun around the earth and all the stars, you know, and in the center of the earth was man, because man was the center of everything. Well, we know so much more now that the sun doesn't actually spin around the earth, doesn't spin around the, how's it go? The sun doesn't spin around the earth, but the earth spins around the sun. And now we know that we're not in the center of anything anymore. In fact, we go on to say we're just nobodies and we're just here of any no consequence. So in that way, you can ignore the Creator, will also ignore the special place man has in his existence. They say that man is the product of chance, is not God's crowning achievement. And I just have to add, talking about being lost. But we have in the Scripture, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar and elements be destroyed with the tenth seat. And we've been studying about that. I believe in the tribulation. And the works and all earth and all its works will be burned up. And I think that is what the tribulation actually does, because it's in the day of the Lord that happens. So, but ignoring global warming and nuclear war, are they the greatest threat? Well, not according to Revelation. It's the coming of the day of the Lord is the great threat to mankind as it has existed since Babylon. We've always hung over this threat. Well, we have noted that as Revelation begins to wind down, we're in the last, chapter 18 today. I get a sense of this winding down. We're not done, but the Revelation is winding down. We've come to the end of the bowl judgments. It's message there that there is a deepening pattern of impending judgments. The end is where the judgment occurs and they pile up. At least six chapters end on the humanity, on humanly speaking, the sour note of destruction. Start with chapter 14. There's only 22 chapters in the book. Perhaps the reader will thus prepare his soul for the end that is coming as a thief in the night. Now, he does not come as a thief in the night for us, because we are prepared, right? Comes in a thief in the night for those that are not prepared. So we have these layer cakes, this layer of cake. Chapter 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 all end up at the same place or the same idea at Armageddon or the time when the Lord comes and judges. That's what we have here. And I thought I might go back and show you that. In chapter 14, it says the blood came up to the bridles. Chapter 17 ends up with the plagues are finished. Chapter 16 says the seventh bowl, sorry, misspell, the plague was in extremely severe. Talking about the bowl, seventh bowl, last bowl. Chapter 17 says, I will show you the judgment. Chapter 18, in light of the lamp, the light of the lamp will not shine, a judgment. Last of the judgment. And then we have 19 tonight, next week, we'll, or not next week, whenever we get to it, is the rest will be killed with a sword. So we don't want to read these chapters, you know, head to tail, you know, they're in basically stacked up like a layer cake. So that ends the Gentiles' independent authority. And that really has been going on since Nimrod. When God has said, this is the way it's going to be, this is my plan, man has said, no, this is the way it's going to be, and this empire building is going on and going on, and it comes to an end at the end of the tribulation when God does away with all of them and he sets up his kingdom. Daniel chapter 2, see the rock crushing the nations that, empires that have gone on before. Okay, last week we said last week that these two chapters, 17 and 18, represent the final lap of man's empire building. At the end of his, this race is his doom. It's like he's running downhill and he can't keep up with his feet and he goes faster and faster and he finally crashes. The aspirations, that is the empires of man, can be summed up in his religious and political practices. This is the two-pronged subject of these two chapters. In some ways, you can pretty well sum up our life by our religion and our politics, or our economics. You know, it's a spiritual world and a real world we live in, where we get our food and so forth, all right? So we have two areas that are dealt with in these two chapters. Both will find their end in the tribulation, the end when, that is, as man has tried to build his empire, in the pouring out of the judgments, the bowl judgments, ending in the return of the Lord with his saints. And that was this picture that I had here. The Gentiles establish independent authority. That effort ends. We start with Nimrod, and we build the Tower of Babel. Sometimes it's think of more of a city with a tower rather than a tower with a city. It's a place where Nimrod tries to establish a system that opposes God, opposes the God of Noah. Fork in the road. Wise philosopher Yogi Berra, don't say the name right, so it's Berra, Yogi Berra, once said that when you come to a fork in the road, to take it. And apparently he was trying to give direction to one of his friends how to get to his house or something. So we have a fork in the road in the interpretive road here. I'm not sure I can settle this totally for you, but we can at least show you the fork, and then you can take it. The question is, in these two chapters, are these two chapters talking about events that are limited to the tribulation in a seven-year period or at the end of it, one branch of the fork, or are these chapters talking about the religious and economic systems that have always been present since Nimrod and Babylon? And I kind of give you those choices. There actually is a third kind of between those two, but the figurative metaphorical fulfillment would be that I don't expect to see a city actually built. So when the city is destroyed, it's the system that's destroyed, the economic system that's destroyed. If you take the right path on this road, of this fork, you find that you have a literal city that's going to be literally built, and it's going to have literal people living in it, and it's going to burn up like a literal fire, and it's going to fall down in a pile, and it's going to smoke. All right, so which is it here? All right, so that's the question. I believe one can argue either way, and I really can't argue either way, and maybe I'll embarrass myself and change my mind. But right now, I'll tell you what the two ways are. One is that the corrupted system of man, that is Babylon, in religion and economics, have been around since the days of language crisis. The Babylon, you know, crisis, Tower of Babel thing, I've got a date for it, 2340, when it's suggested. And we have the other one is that while the systems have been around that long, it would be difficult to make all religion and economic destruction destructive, since both are part of revealed truth. then sorting out the good from the evil, especially in economics, will be nigh impossible. In other words, so you say, well, they've been around all the time, and there's a good part of it, and there's a bad part of it, because we have to have economics. I mean, the Lord has built a system, so we function economically. With has everything to do with our life, earning a living, a place we live, all those kind of things. You eventually get to economics. And there probably is good economics, and there's probably bad economics. There's good practices and bad practices, whatever. So to sort that all out would be very, very difficult, I think. So that's kind of the question. Which way are we going to go? For the purpose of this lesson and for the next foreseeable future, I have a memory of a goldfish, you know, it doesn't last too long. I'm going to assume that while the roots of false religion and corrupted economics is traceable, are traceable, and at times very easily visible to the Tower of Babel, challenged by Nimrod. It's easy to see these two systems being built all the time. The situation Revelation 17, 18 is addressing the two systems at the end of the empire. That's going to be my position, that it's going to be the one on the right. But it can't be totally all in the tribulation, but mostly in the tribulation. Because I think there's certain things I just can't make in the tribulation. So maybe have to fudge a little bit on that. But I don't want to go to the left. Don't want to take the fork to the left. Okay. Now, at the end of the tribulation, this is when they are at their most corrupt state. You know, if it's going downhill from Nimrod, so to speak, at the bottom is where it's the worst. And we get to the end of the tribulation, it is the worst. The Bible talks about it as being the worst time ever. So when we get these, is this not when they are the most corrupt? And at this time, evil is unfettered by the influence of righteousness. I'll talk about that. Because that's sort of let on its own. It's let out of the bag. So why is this choice the plausible one? That is, that judgment is just corresponding to the age corruption, that is not just a general judgment at the end of time, but it's a tribulation judgment. In the most simple terms, it has always been God's intention to keep and protect his creation. Now, God made it. Psalm 24 says he made it. He owns it, everything in it, so he's not going to give it up. It has always been God's intention to keep and protect his creation because he has plans to restore it. And expressed in these terms like regeneration, times refreshing, the restoration, to be set free, and I believe the new heavens and earth fit here. So all of this, we start over in a sense. We go to the back to a Garden of Eden kind of conditions. So to restore it, he must guard it. So there are certain things that cannot be done. There are certain things that he allows. So that point is hardly arguable. Now, there are a few, probably, maybe some of you still think that the world is absolutely going to be utterly destroyed to nothing, and then God will start over with a new, fresh world. And I don't think that's in the character of God at all, because it doesn't let Satan have any victory, not even one like that. So I would say, most of us, this point is hardly arguable, that God's going to keep what he made, keep his creation, by his direct and indirect involvement. And we have glimpses into the spiritual world, knowing that there are battles that are going on at the spiritual level. And I think it was last Sunday, Gail went through Daniel 10 and talked about the battles of the spirits in the time of Daniel, and restricting activity and so forth, and travel in the spirit world. Now, we also know that during the church age, that the spirit acts to restrain the excesses of sin in the world. And in our day, somewhat the same day, the church, that is believers, also have a dampening effect on sinful conduct by living righteously. But the spirit departs when the church is raptured. So we have a different world pressure on the world. In a sense, we have the pattern we see in Romans chapter 1, where God abandons people to their sin. In a sense, God abandons the world to its sin for this short period of time. So a little graphic there for you. The top and the blue part and the bottom blue part is sort of my restraining factor. So we start out with Babylon to the left, where it started. And then the spirit puts clamps on what can be done in the sinful world, because if Satan had his way, he'd destroy all of it. There'd be no more tomorrow. So God has intention to keep what he's made, so he's got to keep it within a certain border, and that's what I'm showing here. And that border is the Spirit's work in life, and then at our church age, we have the Spirit working in individuals. I'm sure they were working in Israel life, too, to promote righteousness in the world, because that was the agency through which God was working. But when these are removed at the rapture, the Spirit's removed because the church leaves, that the unfettered empire can now really go forth. So it is now the time to... Okay, so I think that's what I think is going to happen. Now, the question would be for us, is now the time to abandon the branch and try another fork? That is, for work, we need to abandon to some extent the literal reading of the text. It's difficult for us to understand how this is going to work out at the end. So since we can't work it out at the end, we sort of maybe should abandon our approach. And so I don't want to do that yet, because if we abandon our approach, we have to also abandon the literal interpretation. We don't want to do that. Now, we do once in a while when there's a figure, a metaphor, that you can say, well, that really can't be true, like the woman is a city. Well, that can't be both. You know, so then we see that's a metaphor. But when the city talks about it destroyed, we almost have to leave the city a city. All right? So we kind of stick with that. So we stick with our chosen fork, the end time fulfillment, which is one on the right. Okay, now we visited about the religious destruction last week. Now, that wasn't so difficult because we did not have to deal with rebuilding a city or the vast material wealth necessary to do so, because religion is sort of think in the mind. You know, it's not like something is in the material world, so it's kind of easy to destroy it or build it up. So I say the subject was rather soft, as religious practice can be. But the economic question, the city building, that is different. It's not a soft topic. It's concrete. It's things we touch and feel and can buy and move and destroy. So we're talking about rebuilding a city as a world-class economic center in New York or London or Hong Kong, wherever you want to go. So that's more difficult. Now, little fulfillment, some have suggested with their imagination, the Babylon rebuilt. And if you've ever seen pictures of Dubai and those places down in Arabia, it's really quite remarkable, and they have been built in a very, very short period of time. And as we approach the text, we for the time being lay aside our question, well, how can this be? Just got to quit doing that, because maybe you can't understand how it's done. You just stick with what actually it is saying rather than trying to explain it. Because sometimes we don't understand it because we don't have a presence of how it was then, which is our situation. We don't know what's going to be like in the tribulation exactly. So we ended the point last week, says the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Now that's sort of metaphorical, because the woman isn't that big. It's not huge as the world, and you can see her up there. It's not that, but the influence of this woman, this harlot woman from Babylon, her influence is over all the cities. So there we go, kind of metaphorical or symbolic. But the city, represents that woman, and the reign is literal. It reigns over all the kings of the earth. Now, we're talking here, I believe, after the rapture, we're in the tribulation. So the Antichrist has risen, they call him the beast. And so he's making his presence known in the world, and the false religious system joins with the beast. The two beasts work together to accomplish this. Now, the woman is a metaphor of the great city that influences or controls the earth. The false religious system ends, we are told, and sort of get that idea, or is demoted, perhaps, and then completely destroyed. Now, added to the destruction is the economic half. Now, I left this for you last week, and I'm still not going to totally satisfy myself with this answer on the religious influence or what happens to it. We usually say that, not just better read this, how the religious half is disposed of or to what extent it is disposed of may be open to discussion. Now, can religion be totally done away with completely without any? I think maybe that's the attempt. But we have a problem in the sixth bowl, which is near the end. The demons come out like frogs, or frogs like demons, whichever. They come out of the mouth of the false prophet. Now, the false prophet is the head of this religious system, and he's still functioning. So if he's been destroyed, how can he still be functioning at the end of the tribulation? So I leave this somewhat open. So as I say, I leave it at that, now to focus on the corrupted economic system by the same central Babylon, the harlot, conjuring up the worst kind of economic greed. So this is kind of a quick view of the chapter. And by the way, that when I talk like this, I always assume a little bit, you know a little bit about the text. And I know sometimes you're totally lost in what we're talking about, and I could stop and read the whole text, and I'm difficult for to do it because of time. So I now want to give you the text. In verse 1 of chapter 18 says, now after these things, and by the way, we notice here that we have a specific time marker that goes after these things. So that phrase happens 7 or 8 or 9 times in the book of Revelation, where you know for sure time is being advanced. Otherwise, you don't know. But it says, after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. We're in the 6th and 7th bowl stage now. After these things, another angel, beyond the one we've seen, comes down from heaven having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. Now, if you take that literally, then I'd say he comes down very bright, and the world is like blooms with light. Now, perhaps the recent plague of darkness is still affecting some of the population. Remember, it was just sort of in the administrative area. Well, that certainly now becomes bright. In fact, it is so bright. If you ever look at welding torches? I mean, you just can't look at it. It burns your eyes. You can't look at the sun. It burns your eyes. So I imagine it's that kind of brightness that comes and is an attention getter so that the population is affected. So when the angel illuminates the earth, it is likely blinding light that sends all the earth dwellers, remember those unbelievers, for the shade or sunglasses or inside if they can find a place. It is uncomfortable, maybe even painful attention getter. So the angel shows up. And he now cried, got the attention. Now he cries with a mighty voice saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and the prison of every unclean and hateful bird. Now we got birds involved in here. Things you have Alfred Hitchcock's in the movie, The Birds. Because some people don't like birds, right? If you want to know, there are some people that have really bad, wrong, strong reaction against birds. I mean, some do and some don't. But anyway, in this case, birds that are in the air, which is where you usually find the spirits, kind of connected perhaps, every unclean, hateful bird. The end is announced from the beginning. It's my kind of like, I call this a prolepsis. It's like a... This has probably been going on for a long time. This is one of those stretches on this right branch because it isn't everything in that point because it says here that she has become a dwelling place for demons and a prison for every unclean spirit and a prison for every unclean and hateful bird. Who has been sending these to the prison? Well, I think probably the Lord has been sending these to the prison over lots of years. And it's now at the end that they're going to be released. But that the gathering them into this prison has been going on for a long time, I think, even though I'd say it's all happens at the end, but this is sort of leading up to it. So that's my question here. Did the Lord send these demons to the prison for a latter-day release? It appears so. If we had those that were in the Tigris-Euphrates River, putting there, and they're bound, and they're released at a certain time, so I think we have that going here, without destroying our branch on the right. And now, the rest of the chapter just pretty well makes the same point, which I would like to spend more time on, and maybe I'll do that next week for you, because exactly how this works out in economics, I'm not sure, or what kind of economic system is being practiced here that's being destroyed, I'm not sure. Is it possible that the economic system that's being promoted here is an economic system that opposes God's system? I think God's system, easily proven in the Bible, is what you call a free trade or free market system. We call it capitalism, although, you know, the left has ruined the word a little bit for us because capitalism now somehow has turned into selfishness, and that's not what it means. So is this an extreme example of capitalism going to seed, or is this really another kind of system like socialism that's been forced on the people and finally collapses? That's a question. I want to work on that for you this next week. But in the meantime, we'll just look at what's happening in the text. It's for the nation, I suppose we'd say the people, have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. Everybody's involved in this. Again, we have to take out those that did not receive the mark of the beast, but they're still living in this world. And the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. Now, is this just at the end, or has this always been going on? Well, I'd say first that it has always been going on, but we have to have the compounding of it here at the end. The focus is on economic gain. People, the kings, the merchants have all joyfully benefited from acting in ways that are unfaithful to God and his principles. Now, what are those principles that they're acting against? My question I'm going to address next week, I hope. Now, I heard another voice from heaven, probably another angel, saying, "Come out of her, my people, so that you may not participate in her sins and receive of her plagues." Now, that phrase has been used for lots of things and been used for people coming out of the churches that are faulty, but I'm not sure that's what it's saying here. But this, we're talking about the economic system here. Don't become involved in the economic system. We've been warned not to take the mark of the beast. So it's very difficult to know exactly how this all works because they're living in the world. They're somehow have the option to be in the system or not be in the system. He said, come out of it. Don't participate in it. Maybe that's the story. Come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive her plagues, for her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquity. So there we get that idea that it's been going on for a long time again. And maybe it has been. Even today it's going on. But it, again, doesn't really get the worst until it's just over. And God remembered her iniquities. And God says this about this system: pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds, and the cup which she has mixed twice as much for her. So this idea that when you sin, God doubles up the wrath. Okay? So we're still talking about economic system here. This is kind of what I want to deal with next week. This verse is a problem in my choice of the branch of the fork. With the warning not to receive the mark of the beast, how can my people be potentially involved, thus warned of commercial Babylon? Perhaps the solution is that this steps away from the tribulation event and warns all who from Nimrod down to avoid a commerce that denies the economic plan of God for his creation. And here's what is really going on with this economic system. It's just not normal economics, I don't think. God doesn't destroy normal economics. Something else is going on here. If we have time, we'll deal with, actually are two systems, there aren't more, either capitalism or the socialism. There's none other. So one of these is going to be the system that's being practiced in the tribulation. Now, to the degree that she glorified herself, now we're talking about Babylon here, economic Babylon, and lived sensuously to the same degree, give her torment and mourning, for she says in her heart, I sit as queen, I'm not a widow, you will never see mourning. That's what boastful Babylon says about her system. For this reason, in one day her plagues will come, pestilence, mourning, famine, and she will burn up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. So this is our end of our period, the time when the Lord comes. Again, we pile it up at the end. Now we have this mourning going on because what has been planned is not going to happen. The kings of the earth committed acts of morality and live sensuously with her will weep and lament over her, and when they see the smoke of her burning. So the kings weep and lament when all hope is gone for them, according to their plan. They despair without any recourse. They must follow. Despair must follow. This is the pattern of this section, of the next section. Now the merchants, we can read through all these things. These are things that merchants do. The merchants of the earth weep, mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver, precious stones, pearls, fine linen, purple, silver, scarlet, every kind of Cretan wood, and every article of ivory, every article made, very costly wood and bronze, you know, just stuff. No one buys it. Now so my question is, why don't they buy it? Is it not available? Is there no money to buy it? Okay, those questions are in my mind. And we have, goes on, cinnamon, spice, incense, perfume, frankincense, wine, oil, cattle, sheep, cargoes, horses, pretty much everything, and human lives. Wow. Well, the fruit you long for has gone from you, and all the things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away, and you and the men will find them no longer. So we have a total collapse of the economic system. The merchants of these things who will become rich with her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment. Now we get this, are we talking about a physical something here, or what is it that they're seeing mentally? The weeping in the morning saying, woe, woe, the great city, she who is clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, abandoned, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, the city, the system. For 1 hour, such great wealth has been laid waste, and every shipmaster and every passenger, sailor, and as many make living by the sea, stood at a distance, and they were crying out as they saw the smoke of the burning, saying, what city is like the great city? So it's very difficult to stay totally literal here, you do want to drift to the metaphorical. So I'm sticking with the literal here. And they threw dust on their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city which all have had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she was laid waste. Now heaven says, rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles," we don't have apostles since New Testament, "prophets," we've not had prophets since the New Testament, and we go back to the Old Testament, they have prophets were big, "because God has announced judgment for you against her." So all these people that have waited all these years for God's judgment now finally have their prayers answered. The joy of justice reaches back to the Old Testament period. Again, back to part, again, part of Babylon must reach back to the original Nimrod incident. But the justice is granted in the final victory at Armageddon. You got to think that we really need to have patience sometimes. You know, God's been waiting for 6,000 years, maybe not quite that long, to Babel. He destroyed the world once, then he started over again with the flood. So we have this pent up, and we find that it piles up, judgment piles up on humanity, and finally it gets released. Now, we have just a little picture of how God deals with this, or God's feeling about this, is when the strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone. This is a picture, this object lesson. And he threw it into the sea, saying, "So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer. And the sound of the harpists and musicians and flute players and the trumpeters will be heard in you any longer. And no craftsman or any crafts will be found in you any longer. And the sound of a mill will not be heard in you any longer. And the light of a lamp will not shine in you any longer. And the voice of the bridegroom and the bride will not be heard any longer. And your merchants were the great men of the earth, because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of prophets," again, Old Testament now, "and the saints," probably the New Testament people, "and all of them that have ever been believers, of all who have been slain on the earth." So we have a lot of judgment to make up here. And remember, we start out by the heaven was rejoicing. And that ends that. So my question that I have is just, where does this system lie? Is this a system? It can't be just pure capitalism, a good stuff. It just can't be that alone. And it isn't totally socialism unless, this is what I'm thinking, unless it is what you call managed government. In other words, everything is managed from the top down. And if that would be the case, if everything is managed from the top down, I mean, everything is managed from the top down. And that would make sense, because we've got 6-6 on everybody's hand or forehead that's going to do commerce or buy something in the system. So everything is forced, and when everything is forced, maybe the economic system can grow a lot faster than we would think. And then when it seems to run out, which they always say, socialism always runs out of capitalism's money, and when that happens, everything collapses. Now, I'm just saying that's what's happening here, but that would happen in a normal system that deals with an anti-biblical system of economics. It finally collapses, and it collapses severely. No one can buy, no one can sell, no one makes, nothing. No one's moving, there's no transportation. Of course, we have all the disintegration during the tribulation. We don't know whether electronic communications are going to happen. We're going to have to go back to horseback riding. I don't know. All these kind of questions are out there. So I'm just going to take a little time. Maybe it won't go anywhere and I'll do something else, but I want to look at this and see what is it exactly that's happening in this economic collapse. Why did it collapse? Because it doesn't say that God did anything. You know, God didn't say, "Well, I took away the value of money," or "I took away all their gold." It doesn't say that. It just it collapsed. It's like as if it almost collapsed on its own self, which is probably fine, because we find that in many of our sins, corporately, that there is an inbuilt, there's a built-in judgment that goes with the sin. Romans chapter 1. You get into devious sexual activity. The end of it is you'll end up with some disease that goes with it. One of them is AIDS, and it's a destruction of your own person because it goes with the sin. So maybe we have a destruction that goes with the system here that just happens because it just can't sustain itself. And of course, God gets credit for it because he allows it to go on and just lets it fall into its bottom and it's totally destroyed. Now, how it gets to be burning up, you know, those we have more like intervention of God. Maybe there's a burning, you know, judgment that God doesn't say. But there's nothing really said directly where God does something to destroy it. It just is destroyed.